Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York. And live.
You say Dave's Gone By.
Yeah. But remember, my name's Dave. Dave's Gone. My wife thought of the title. What can I say?
Oh, your wife. Dave's of our lives.
Dave's of our lives. Well, you know what? Here's the intro right here. I was going to do this whole long sweeping thing, but instead...
No, go ahead. I'll just sit here and listen to you. Then you'll introduce me, and we'll all be...
You've introduced yourself. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the voice...
Nobody knows who I am yet.
Right. Well, there you go. See, I was gone.
Tell them, Dave. Tell them.
No, you know what? Better yet, you do it. Let's hear.
No, I'm too embarrassed. I'm too shy. I'm too humble. Okay, I'm Peter Tork.
You're Peter Tork. Or, and I never knew this, your name actually was Peter Halston Thorkelson.
Well, actually, the H is silent.
It's Olson?
No.
Oh, it's Thorkelson.
Thorkelson, yes.
Oh, yes.
Otherwise, I'd have been Peter Thork.
That's true.
So, silent H, Peter Tork. As a matter of fact, the interesting thing is that it came about... Because in my Greenwich Village days, I was wearing my father's high school sweatshirt, and it said Tork on the back of it. It was his nickname.
Oh, so that's what they call it. Okay. The name was Torkelson.
Yeah.
Shortened
his
it to Tork.
Was Tork, right. Got shortened that way. And for a long time, I wasn't even Peter Tork. I was just Tork. And some of my friends from back then still just call me Tork as though it were my first name, which is kind of funny.
And then you went to, like, Actors Equity and shortened it for real, or do you still get mail addressed to Torkelson?
If you shorten it at Actors Equity, then that's just still a stage name.
Oh, you're right.
No, actually, yeah. Your name is anything you say it is, as long as you're not changing it for fraudulent purposes, according to a good law. So as far as I'm concerned, they're both still my real name.
Cool.
I'm actually Peter Tork and Peter Torkelson, and the mail comes to the same address no matter what.
Cool. And that address would be, so we could all send you mail. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. No, sometimes the mailman giggles when he puts the mail in my box.
Oh, you have a strange mailman then. But, you know...
Tell me about it.
Talking about strange days, now obviously we will get to the most famous band you were in and also the band that you are currently in, but let's roll it back a little bit because I did not realize until I was doing research before the interview that you were starting around that time of the whole folk scene in the 60s. I didn't realize that it started that early for you.
That's right. I was in that... Well, if we count the Weavers as the first wave, and then we count the Dylan days as maybe the second, then I would be in the third wave because I was there right after Dylan, along with the guy, the artist currently known as Roger McGuinn, who, of course, went on to great fame with the Byrds.
Right.
Jose Feliciano had a few records out for a little while. Richie Havens was on the street in those days. And so was Stephen Stills, of later of Buffalo Springfield and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young, sometimes.
You got to throw Young in there, you know.
Sometimes.
I know he's not always with them, but yeah.
That's right, CSN, CSNY, just as it's like the famous band that I used to belong to. For years, three of us went out as instead of the quartet.
True.
And didn't seem to bother anybody.
And sometimes it was the three of you and Neil Young, which was really strange.
That was very strange. Yeah. That was very peculiar. Yeah.
And especially since he was in his trans mode at the time and doing electro voice stuff. Well, you were still doing, Neil Diamond songs.
Bubblegum trance music.
Well, that was Gary Newman, wasn't it? No, but anyway.
Very good.
Thank you. So Stephen Stills and you struck up a friendship, kind of a musical.
Actually, it began, these people came up to me and said, "There's this new kid in the street, he looks just like you." And about 2-3 days later, I ran across him. I said, "Ah, you're the kid that looks like me." He said, "Ah, you're the kid I'm supposed to look like." And we shook hands and had a laugh. And we've been friends ever since.
And you did the Harpo Marx mirror thing when you met him, too. That was kind of...
Yeah, right. That would have been great.
It would have been cool. By the way, and it Stills apparently was the fella who convinced you to audition for a TV show.
That's correct. He got from him... that he met one of the producers of said TV show socially. And in the course of conversation, it came up for Stephen that he was not telegenic, that his hair and teeth weren't going to look good on television. And did he know anybody who looked like him? And amazingly enough, he did, and it was me. They neglected to mention talent, but they didn't ask me about that before they signed me on.
Well, you know, there's probably a myth that still persists to this day about the most the well-known band that you were in, the Monkees, of course.
The Monkees, yes.
That you guys couldn't play your instruments. That it was
well,
played by session musicians.
Oh, well,
you were...
No, it's true. It's true. That's not a myth. The session musicians did play on the records, particularly the first two LPs.
But you were,
then.
A musician.
Yes, I was.
So did you not even have to play, or were you playing and all the other three were not, or what was the deal?
The deal was that they were making records, the background tracks for the records were all being made by a bunch of professional record makers, guys who were in the, were working as signed, contracted record producers and songwriters, under the direction of one Don Kirshner, known at the time as the Man with the Golden Ear. They were making these records, and it was, at the time I was very upset about it, but it, as I look back now, I see how intelligent it was. We were four young actors. They'd chosen us because we weren't conventional Hollywood actor types who knew the ropes and knew how to be professional. And they wanted wild and crazy guys, and it meant that it was a lot more difficult to make a TV show than it otherwise would have been. And we were working all the time making television, and they needed records out, and they made records and put them out. One of us was singing lead on every cut.
Right.
It was always somebody singing leads. But the background tracks were being made, and they're a good thing, too, because as it turns out, I did not know how to make a record in those days until we were well underway. I learned how to make a record, and I think I can make a good record now, but I didn't have any idea then. And so it really was critical. It was required that that somebody else make the records while we were making the TV show, because clearly with the Monkees, the most important thing was that the faces appear on the screen. The Beatles went about it differently. Their faces went on screen after their music made it. But we were primarily a TV show, and so... You know, like I said, I was upset at the time, but now I see that there was no reason for me to be.
Right, and after the third and fourth album, you guys, I guess, started to have more musical
input. Third album, we made the third album all by ourselves.
Right.
Pretty much. Yeah, and I listen to it now, and it's certainly about the same as the first two. And in fact, the third album had a longer half-life than the second. So, you know, there must have been something in it that the fans appreciated or liked, because while it didn't outsell the second, however high it went, it took longer to slope off, if you know what I'm saying.
And just remind people of the names of the first three albums.
The first album was Meet the Monkees, the second was More of the Monkees, and the third was Headquarters.
Okay, there you go. And that, yeah, Headquarters
and
has seemed to be...
The fourth was Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones,
mm-hmm.
which was a kind of... We went into a mixed mode after the third album. Mickey felt that he couldn't play drums as well as he might want to. And, in fact, he wasn't a great drummer, but, you know, he was our drummer, and that was enough for me. I liked him playing drums. He was a wild and crazy drummer, but he didn't want to do it. Jonesy's rhythm part when we were making the tracks was banging a tambourine.
Right.
He got good and sick of it and took a terrible bruise on his hand, so he hung that up. So Michael and I played guitar and keys and bass and what have you on a lot of the cuts after that. But we also had professional studio musicians working with us, so we went into a kind of a mixed mode. Hi, this is Peter Tork, former and maybe sometime Monkey, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
Was it kind of weird working on a TV show that was geared for young America and was kind of like a pop art cartoon at the same time that it was so into the psychedelic era at that point?
Well,
that...
no, I think that your timing is just a hair off.
Okay.
Psychedelia didn't hit, really, until we were well underway. It was at least not the mainstream. And, of course, the main thing about Hard Days, about the Monkees, was that it was a Hard Days Night-style show, and that was romps and you know, guys being cheeky.
Right.
That was what it was about.
But did it get weird after the first season or two where you, again, as it was sort of with the Beatles when they got a little older and they felt confined in certain characters that they had to be, was there a point when you were already getting a couple of years older, a little more seasoned, and yet you had to run around and still be crazy, goofy people? I mean, or was
no,
it fine?
No. Crazy, goofy was what we've... I did best. I'm crazy and goofy to this day.
Good.
And maybe if you're a really good boy, I'll be crazy and goofy for you sometime in the near future. But in the meantime, no, we stretched out. The Monkee movie was us getting pretty psychedelic,
yeah.
actually. It was, I don't know if you've seen it, but it was a very surreal, well, no, I beg your pardon, let's see, what is it? Yes.
Head.
It was impressionistic, yeah. Head. It was surreal and impressionistic. It was not abstract, as it turns out, because there's actually something going on there. But it was, we were honoring the psychedelic times for sure.
And
when the time came.
I mean, people may not remember this, but there's actually an episode of The Monkees with Frank Zappa in it.
That's right.
Where
well, he
playing the bicycle.
Or? Guessed it with Michael Nesmith. It's really interesting. You know, Michael looks, one of the things to me, Michael and Michael put on a Zappa nose and hair and mustache to try to look like Zappa, and it's the two of them. It's really interesting, except that Zappa is like really a hard working, cold-blooded guy in a lot of ways. And
Well, he was.
And Nesmith looks like a cream puff pastry.
Do you have any memories of not only meeting Zappa, but let's say if you guys ever met the Beatles or some of the major icons of it? Well,
sure.
What are some specific recollections?
We met the Beatles and the Monkees, three of the Monkees. I can't remember, or at least two. I thought it was which one of them. Ringo didn't show. And I think neither Michael nor David came, but Mickey and I went and met the other three Beatles, and of course it was fabulous, you know, what the hell, you just see my idols, get to meet them and hang out and laugh and have a few jokes. If somebody was nearby, and I, like Mick Jagger was recording in the next studio, and I said, Mac, drop in and say hello, nobody said, no, you can't because you're just some schlub from the street, you know, that aspect of things was fabulous, to be able to say, you know, hey, Mick Jagger's working. How are you? Nice to meet you.
Well, one of the stories that fascinated me that was told when I was in an acting class back in college was a girl said that she remembered being taken by her mom to see the Monkees at, and we did a Giant Stadium or Shea Stadium, some really huge, like, local stadium. And all these kids were there screaming with their, you know, we love Mickey and the Peter, with the, you know, the young girls going crazy because these TV pop idols are going to be out there. But they had no idea what to make of the opening act, who was this very colorful black man with a guitar. I think you know where I'm going with this.
As if everybody listening didn't.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, do you have any memories of being the... Well, or of Jimi Hendrix being your opening act.
Surely.
Well.
Of course. What do you think? I actually do remember much of the 60s.
No, I'm saying specific anecdotes. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Well, yes, of course. Mickey and I saw Jimmy at Monterey Pop Festival. I didn't make Woodstock, but I think Monterey was the better festival anyway, as it turns out for me. But I saw Jimmy, and I didn't get it because... he burned his guitar, and The Who had just been on and just smashed their guitars. It was their act.
Right.
And I thought, I just saw this act. What the hell is this? You know. But Mickey got it. Mickey heard the fabulous musicianship, which I came to appreciate later. And Mickey got arranged for Jimmy to be the opening act on the Monkees tour in, I think it was 67 or 68. And the kids were not ready for Jimi Hendrix. I mean, what they were interested in was, you know, their pop bubblegum rave faves. And here comes this nasty music. I mean, this music was like, I mean, it was, you know,
of course.
You look back on it, and it was the best music of the day. And I believe you have to say Jimi Hendrix will remain through history as the best rock guitar player ever. Of course, and ferocious. I mean, part of what made him great was that his... he had so much energy and drive, and it was so so real. And the Monkees, one of the things about the Monkees was it was about escapism in large measure.
Speaking of escapism, don't want to dwell too much on bad stuff. And also, yes, we're going to get to the fact that you are still making music, and maybe sometimes, I guess, still with the Monkees, but also mostly with your other band called Shoe Suede Blues. Let's get to that break so we make sure we have time to mention that. That's,
please.
Is it a bluesy band? Is it a country blues? What kind of...
Not country.
Okay.
Very much out of the blues tradition. We start somewhere between Chicago blues and the 50s blues pop era.
Mm-hmm.
Little Richard remains... equally remains one of the great rock singers. I think the greatest rock singer of all time. I don't think anybody's ever going to be a better singer than Little Richard was. And sometimes still is, for that matter. I mean, when he's at 70-odd, you know, he can still put it out for a short amount of time and scorch you. He's just scorching. And there was this moment in pop music when pop and blues and country all were the same music, or they all overlapped massively. And somewhere between the traditional Chicago blues and that moment in pop blues music history is the focal starting point of Shoe Suede Blues. And we go in every direction from there. We go back to some Louis Jordan pre-R&B, and we do some modern songs that we've written in the blues mode, and some songs. We even do monkey songs in a kind of a bluesy vein.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a couple of CDs out, I believe.
We have a couple of CDs out. One of them is basically not available any longer. It's a live CD, Mike and Ea recording. But the other one is Saved by the Blues, and it's available still to this day. You can get it on the website, petertork.com or shoesuedeblues.info.
Okay. And by the way, that's Peter Tork without the H, folks. Just relining, folks.
Harking back as if anybody was listening from that moment till this.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, people surf the dial even between the commercials on this show. That's right. Thank you so much.
Yes, yes.
Well, in that case, then I'm going to ask sort of an uglier question, okay?
You think you've just got justification now, right?
Yes,
okay,
yes. Now I have a reason to ask a dark question.
Okay.
You had the great TV show, very popular. You had money coming in. Why did, you've been married, what, 3 times at this point? And there was drugs and alcohol, too. So how did you pull yourself out of some of the bad stuff that happened after incredible success?
Well, it's success and the use and abuse of chemistry, drugs and alcohol. I'm not sure what the relationship is. It certainly is not true, as some have asked of me, whether, in my case anyway, fame led to chemical abuse. I think, on the contrary, the kind of brain and mind and heart that goes to chemical abuse also goes to show business as a way of compensating for the conviction, right or wrong, that you're underappreciated in private life. The course of the addiction has a line of its own and is immutable. If you're partaking at all, you will ride this line to death. If you don't participate, the line will continue without you. And if you should rejoin it, it will take you right back to wherever it is at the moment. As of right now, I have not had a drink or a drug in almost 25 years.
Knock wood. All right.
Thank you. But I have heard enough evidence and seen enough or been told reliable eyewitnesses enough to believe and to know and to believe that if I were to start drinking, I would suddenly be back where I was if I'd been drinking continuously for the last 25 years. In other words, the course of the disease, it really is a disease, or the syndrome, if you don't like the word disease, the course of alcoholism and drug abuse is immutable. It goes on without you if you're not partaking.
So, do you go weekly to meetings and that kind of thing, or monthly to meetings, or how?
Whether I go to meetings or not is not something that would be the concern of anybody in public.
Sure. Okay.
But it is certainly true that I've relied on a lot of help to get to stay sober, and that I couldn't have done it by myself. In fact, trying to do it by yourself is part of the disease, part of addiction, the addictive process. Addictive behavior is having to do it by yourself and believing you have to do it by yourself. And I've been blessed not to have to do it by myself, to have a large measure of help. Certainly no way to do it without. I continue to rely on that help because it's what got me sober, and why would I want to abandon what got me sober and health, relatively healthy? How healthy you want to call this. I'm better off. There's no getting around that.
And I brought up also, are you married now?
No, I'm not.
You're not? Okay. So single looking, single sick of women, single into sheep, what? Where are you at?
I don't know what to say. I'm dating a lot.
Ah, cool.
I have nobody on the horizon that I am sure is the one other. I think I'm probably past the point in my life where finding the one and falling in love and agreeing to try to create something together is possible. On the other hand, it would certainly I would certainly love to have a companion that I thought was knew me and understood me and with whom I could partner. Hi, you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB, and this is Peter Tork trying to tell you so.
Do you have a good relationship with your kids?
Yes, I do.
Oh, cool.
Very good. My daughter tells me that my relationship with my son is a little problematical, but of my two daughters, the adult daughter says that she has a better relationship with me than any of her friends have with their fathers. So,
hopefully that is a good thing.
It's a good thing for us, yeah. And,
yeah.
Yeah, right, and I hope that the others aren't catastrophic, because otherwise it means, otherwise it's small praise, but you know, yes, we're doing fine. It's wonderful.
Back to happier questions also, and we're going to wrap this up with Peter Tork of Shoe Suede Blues, and of course formerly the Monkees. Got to ask, favorite Monkee song?
Ryu Shiu.
Hmm. Because?
When you say song, I don't know. It's, in some ways, that's not a Monkee song.
Right.
We did Ryu Shiu in front of the cameras for a Christmas episode. And it was the four of us sitting there singing live into the camera. And I think the vocal blend is astounding. It's a cappella, which is just, you know, and I think it's ferocious. I think that you can't tell who's singing what part. The vocal blend is so good throughout. So we're very, I'm very pleased with that. My favorite hit was Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Hmm.
I think Head is my favorite album, CD now, because it's got a bunch, it's got two of my songs on it, and it's got a lot of psychedelia, and Jack Nicholson coordinated the CD from the soundtrack of the movie, and there's a couple of great Carole King songs on it, and overall, I think that's the most pleasurable single listening experience of a album / CD.
Do you have a favorite song, period? Not necessarily a Monk song at all, but just...
No. There's dozens and dozens of really wonderful songs. It's impossible to choose among them. I mean, what are you going to do between Lady Madonna and What a Fool Believes, for instance? Or, I mean, I haven't heard anything recently that's totally knocked. The most recent thing that I loved, which I think is the music of Been Caught Stealing by Jane's Addiction, scorched me. I thought it was the best sounding cut I'd heard in 15 years, but I don't know about those lyrics because it seems a little strange to me. And so on, you know, all these kinds of things. So there's no knowing.
And I guess we can't really leave this without the usual question. Obviously, you've been asked the favorite question a few times because you were just, like, rattling those off. But the other one is, how often are you in contact with the other three, and when you guys doing another thing together or in pairs or twosomes, that sort of thing?
Nobody has any plans at the moment to join up with any of the others. There is some discussion of some possibilities. There's some faint possibilities wafting through the ether. There's no knowing whether it'll come to anything. If it does, there might be a what the fans call the Three Keys show this year. The 40th anniversary is coming up, which would be great to get started on something like that. But it, people are not deeply enthusiastic about the idea. There's drawbacks from everybody's point of view, so we don't know whether it'll happen or not. It also could. So keep your eyes open. We might come to your town.
You all still basically get along. I mean, maybe not if you're on a long 5-month tour.
We don't have much to say to each other. We find that we don't have much of a community of interest.
Hmm.
I don't talk to Michael at all, just because he kind of dumped on us. So, you know, he was supposed to come and do a tour with us, and he just reneged without a word.
Well, he's probably looking for a job right now because, you know, he was on the radio station in New York. I don't know if you...
No.
That's not Michael. That's Mickey. Mickey.
Mickey doesn't need to worry.
Well, no, certainly not.
He's working
but I'm
all
saying.
He wants. And Michael is pretty rich. He's not in Gates League, but he's got a lot of money by my standards.
Well, from the liquid paper,
Yeah, his mother invented liquid paper, and that
And so, and he's doing his own music and his own video stuff, although he's been rather quiet, I think, for the past few years. But are all three guys still sort of simmering about the fact that he sort of like, well, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm kind of above this teen stuff I was doing.
I won't.
You were kind of going there already.
How can I talk for the other guys?
I'm sorry. Okay, cool. Yeah.
They might not give it a thought from one end of the year to the next. And I don't know that I would either if people didn't ask me. I just know that I don't care to have anything to do with Michael as things stand. But as far as Mickey and Davey goes, I have a lot of I still have a lot of respect for Michael. I'm not this is not not to say that he's proven to be useless as a human being or an artist. But I still have a lot of affection and respect for the other two guys as well. And if something came up, I'd be glad to be hanging out with their company. It's a lot of fun touring with those guys. They're funny, funny men. You know, the two of them, just hilarious. Great.
Well, you know what?
All day.
Let's then close on something wonderful, like your favorite, most wonderful experience as a performer. And it can be with the Monkees or not necessarily. It can be with Shoe Suede Blues. But
No, I can't do that for you. I haven't got a single favorite experience. Oh. My life is a bundle of joy from one end of the day to the next.
Oh, please.
Oh, okay.
Well, I guess when you're sober for 25 years, it probably is.
I'm exaggerating a little.
Okay. Well, pick two moments that are wonderful for you.
Well, you know, this is a wonderful moment. I'm gazing over at my computer screen. It's showing me pictures of the cosmos on my screensaver, and that's just a wonderful visual.
Oh, sure. You're looking at porn. Admit it. You're looking at porn. Don't lie.
I'm kidding. Not to say I never have or wouldn't again, but I certainly am not at the moment. It's a great, wonderful picture of the moon on a brilliant LCD screen. And I'm currently wandering around a house whose core was built in 1755.
Whoa.
And with the wood stove burning away, and my guitar player from the band, Shoe Suede Blues, is already here, and we laugh a lot, and we have great jokes, and we talk good stuff, what could be finer? Come the late winter and the spring, I'll go down into the fields and start tapping the trees and make some maple syrup. And
nice.
You know, life is really nice for me right now.
I got to say, you know what? You're convincing me. Maybe it is pretty much all smiles from morning till night. That's pretty,
not bad.
That's,
I mean, it's
cool,
you know, it's not that there aren't things that are disappointing that happen now and again. I mean, a bad episode of West Wing will just really bring me down.
Well, Peter Tork, you've brought us all up for a half hour of wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Wish you best of luck with Shoe Suede Blues and everything that you do.
Thank you.
Thanks.